The Supreme Court's historic decision regarding the constitutionality of same-sex marriage reflects the dramatic impact the rule of law has on intimate partnerships. Now more than ever, those involved in family relationships, including heterosexual and same-sex marriage partners, and those in less structured cohabitation arrangements, need to understand how formal and informal contracts shape the emotional, financial, and legal terrain in personal relationships. Now in the new book, Love's Promises, Martha Ertman, a law professor at the University of Maryland's Carey Law School, has an extensive background in contract law, explores how deals and contracts create and transform all kinds of families. Again, the name of the book is Love's Promises, and it's a pleasure to welcome Martha Ertman to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you here. What brought you down this path of wanting to look at contracts?
Oh, well, anybody who's looked at contracts know you just get a little taste of it and you have to have more. My students often tell me that they're surprised. They thought it would be deadly dull. And then we study surrogacy contracts. We study living together agreements. We study all kinds of arrangements that make it really clear that contracts are not just about, you know, developing a shopping mall. That, in fact, it's about human life and how people plan for things they hope will work out okay. And that's the long answer. The short answer is my dean told me to when I was a very young professor, but I'm not a young professor anymore.
So let me ask the question that I think is out there, the elephant in the room, if you will, which is when you engage in a contract with another individual in regards to a personal relationship, does it not in some way, shape, or form reflect some degree of mistrust?
Right. That's a great question. I'm so glad you started with it, because that's why I have some memoir in the book, as well as these stories about other kinds of family contracts. So if you'll indulge me for a moment, I find myself in my 30s. I want to have a baby. I don't know quite how to go about doing it. I'm lesbian, so I could call a sperm bank, but I don't want to do it all myself. So I call my friend Victor, my old friend from school, and I ask him, do you want to have a baby? And he's kind of quiet. Then he asks me, what do you have in mind? And I tell him what I have in mind. He says, let's keep talking. And we do keep talking. And one day, he tells me he's inclined to inseminate, which is, I think, how a gay man says, yeah, sure, I'll have a baby with you. And a year and a half later, that baby comes out healthy and happy, and Victor's become my best friend. But of course, we don't get to take advantage of the on-the-rack rules, because we're hoping we're going to find sweethearts, which we do by the end of the memoir chapter at the beginning. Your readers would find out. But that if we hadn't sat down and talked to each other, then we might have argued about how do you pay for daycare and where does the kid live and what's the kid's name going to be. And so I think it's actually more unfriendly in many circumstances to just close your eyes and cross your fingers and brush something under the rug than actually have a conversation about who you are to each other.
When it comes to those conversations, how hard is that? Because it seems to me because let's say you're in love.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Let's say you're in love.
The love is the mystery part. That's
right.
The mystery part, and it's the engine that drives all of these contracts. You're not making them with the person you get your cappuccino from in the morning.
Right. So if you're having, you know, there's nothing sexy about then asking for somebody to sit down and make a contract.
Well, this is the interesting thing. Traditionally, engagement, the height of romance, is highly contractual. In fact, in the 19th century, breach of promise to marry cases clogged U.S. courtrooms. So, in fact, it used to be that engagement was a legally binding promise. And, of course, marriage is a legally binding promise, which is why it was such a huge deal that the Supreme Court decided to extend it to same-sex couples. So I think the lie in there, or the myth, is that law and love are enemies. But in fact, I would say part of the way you know you're in a love relationship is that you have these kinds of rights and duties to each other. And the source of those rights and duties, in part, is that if somebody changes their mind, they don't get to just go home with all the donuts. They have to share the law treats you like an us. And so part of why I wrote in this memoir voice that is, I hope, a little bit warm and showing the love behind my own family agreements will make people say, gosh, I'm moving in with my boyfriend. Why can't I share a bedroom and a bathroom, but we can't talk about whether I'm on the lease? Because the fact is, it's people who are not on the lease, who aren't on the title to the house, that end up in a one-down position at the end of the game by not talking.
What is it about these situations? Because if you look at the, if you look at the data, if you look at statistics, they certainly aren't in favor of those who are going to go into a relationship, whatever that may be, and have it work out for the best. Those, in many cases, are the minority. So then switching my my demeanor a bit and saying, well, right, why, for goodness sakes, why wouldn't you go into a contract?
That's the question.
Yeah.
I think we have a romantic idea, and I think therapists talk about this more than lawyers, that we can read each other's minds. That because I want to raise the children Jewish, you must want to raise the children Jewish. Because I think I'm going to cook and you're going to clean up. You must have that same belief. And of course, if you don't talk about it, you're going to be bickering about it for a while until you figure it out. So I think actually what it is that if we can talk a little bit more about what we give and get from each other. In fact, it increases the appreciation. A friend read the book in draft. I had, in order to try to write this book in a way that people would want to read on the beach or on the treadmill, I had lots and lots of people read it outside of law and outside of universities. One woman whose husband does almost nothing read it, and she went to her husband and she said, hey, why don't you help out a little more? Because the second half of the book is how people generally have give and take in a household. And this one particular woman was kind of doing everything. And he said, well, what do you want me to do? And she said, I don't know. And he said, well, make a list. Make a list of what you do. And she made a list of all the making sandwiches and taking the kids to soccer practice and all the rest of it and how long each one took. And she was surprised by actually putting it all down. And he was surprised, and he said, all right, well, let me take these three, boom, boom, boom. And then what they did afterwards is they ripped it up because, as you say, they trust each other. My question is, what's so untrusting about having a record when your hearts were full so you can remember the kind of person you want to be instead of the kind of person you end up being when things are, when it's a little less convenient to keep your promises?
Okay. So can I answer that question?
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that the problem is, because I agree, it sounds great, but then just by doing that, it seems that perhaps you are saying, because there is that chance that this won't work out, and then the other person says, well, oh, okay, well, if you don't think it's going to work out, then why should I think it's going to work out? And then
right,
the conversation just devolves.
Right. And this is why most people don't make wills, because they don't want to think about death. Of course, you don't want to think about the terms that contract lawyers call end game provisions. You want to just assume everything is going to work out well. And some people think it increases the chance of it working out well if they don't even acknowledge, if they sweep that under the rug. For me, remember, I'm a lesbian. I have a baby with a gay man. There are all kinds of reasons to think this could turn into a nightmare. So what I did is actually planned for the possibility of disagreements and said, okay, if we have these deals that are not legally binding, but will remind us to be decent human beings. And fortunately, 11 years into the game, we haven't had to use them. But I like to think, because we know that if we have a big disagreement, that we agree we'll go into therapy. If nobody can be a human being and act like decent in therapy, then we would go to this thing called mediation, which is short of litigation. And this is where I really built in a big wall to being adversarial, where I put in something I call jerk insurance. At the time I make the agreement with my baby daddy, I'm living in Utah. He's living in Texas. They're both totally red states. We're two gay friends having a baby. The likelihood of having a judge look at us in a friendly way if we're arguing is not that high. So I put in a provision that forces us to go to Massachusetts to argue in court and to have that court apply Massachusetts law. So what that does is build a huge wall that either one of us would have to scale in order to even just get into a courtroom. That, in fact, I think is friendlier and keeps us talking to each other because it takes away the big guns that would hurt the child, of course, most of all.
Much of the book has to do with this idea of alternatives when it comes to having children and alternative arrangements. And what I think is fascinating is we talk about having children, and obviously this is so emotional, and people are engaging it with so many alternative methods that you would think that that courts would be flooded with lawsuits, even without the contracts that you're talking about. But that is not the case.
That's so interesting. It was my intuition that was the case, just from living in the world and knowing a bunch of people who've been in adoption and reproductive technology situations. And then when I actually crunched the cases and looked at them, there are very, very few cases. Take just alternative insemination. In the years between 1990 and 2010 or so, there were about 40,000 babies a year born through alternative insemination. And yet, there are just a couple dozen cases. So I think what that means, people are mostly giving and getting what they want. The system is not broken. So sperm banks are very carefully screening their donors, and the donors are telling the truth about their medical background and other things. And the recipients are doing fine, too, with this situation where the children born of donor gametes can get online and look at the donor sibling registry and find out all kinds of information. So I guess for me, my own personal story is I have never been so called for anything other than having a baby. I was just driven to do it for reasons I don't even have words to describe. And what I was able to do is find a way to do that. And I think lots of other people are in that same situation, too.
Martha Erdman is the author of Love's Promises, How Formal and Informal Contracts Shape All Kinds of Families. Talk to me a little bit about the difference between formal and informal, of when a contract should be formal, when a contract should be informal, and at what point do you reach a level where you say, okay, we don't need a contract for this, but we do need a contract for that.
Right. Well, contract is legalese for a legally binding agreement. So if you're talking around law nerds, they're going to say contract means that the force of the state is behind the promise. You have to keep your word. And I had to really try very hard to come up with language to describe the informal promises that I think define relationships just as much as the legally binding ones, if not more so. So the most common arrangement in a living together arrangement is you cook and I clean up. Very, very common. Obviously, nobody's expecting that to get into court. It gets a little more dicey when you have an open adoption. You have a birth family. The birth mom wants to have a little contact to know the child that she is unable to raise is doing all right in the adoptive family. In that situation, historically, post-adoption contact agreements, or PACAs, that will allow her to have, say, a letter a year or maybe some pictures every year or, on the high end, some visits with the child, those were treated as just deals until about 10, 15 years ago. And now half the states treat them as legally binding. So part of what I want in this book, and why I wrote it in an informal voice with this memoir story and the story of my own mother's adoption in 1930, was hoping to get to adoption professionals and adoptive parents to say that having the agreements for post-adoption contact be legally binding actually works well. It seems to work well for the kids. They want to know a little bit about their background. It decreases the chance of prolonged grief. in the birth mom from having to relinquish her child. And then actually, it makes the adoptive parents feel more entitled because the birth mom has actually said, I pick you. So I guess that just like with the same-sex marriage case, people live their lives in different ways. Love shows up in different packages. So both contracts and deals can tailor those packages. And depending on the situation, maybe it should be legally binding or not.
So you mentioned Massachusetts as part of your contract. So in some cases, you're shopping for a fair trial. And I guess that's brings up two questions to me. One is it would seem to me then that because laws are changing so frequently, that whatever contract you do enter would have to be amended and updated fairly frequently, correct?
Well, not necessarily. What it is you can write it in a general way and then the background rules may change. And that happens all the time. If you were married in 1950, then divorced in 1975, you got married under a regime where you could only get divorced for adultery or extreme abuse. But you got divorced for no fault. Anybody gets to decide to do it. So the rules change. I actually hope that people will realize these contracts are not as complicated as they think. This is why in my appendix to the book, I include the copy of my own contract with my baby daddy, Victor, an open adoption agreement that worked fine, and a cohabitation agreement that's really short and simple from a form book, showing that this is not rocket science. You don't have to amend it all the time. There aren't even a lot of immense formalities. But what the key is just saying who you are to each other with the idea that if things go south, you'll read that first and maybe you'll remember that you entered into this with a full heart before somebody slept with someone's sister or became an alcoholic or, you know, shaved their head and joined a religious cult.
So if you're going to court, is there a typical of what a court will typically decide of who has parental responsibilities to a child born through, let's say, an alternative method and with a contract that you have devised?
Right. That's a huge question, and it differs state to state because family law differs state to state. That's partly why it was such a huge deal when the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Obergefell because it really standardizes the rule across the country. With parenthood, that would differ from state to state, and it really is, if you're talking about there's a couple cases now where a donor of sperm is given sperm away on Facebook or on Craigslist and then has a formal agreement with the women who receive it, but the question is that enforceable? There are two questions that might come up most commonly. One is one of the women goes on public assistance and the state wants to make him pay child support. The other is where he wants to start going to the Little League games. He wants to say how the child is being raised religiously and so forth. And so depending on how they did the insemination, was it in a doctor's office or was it at home? Did they have sex? All of those things make a difference. The general rule is, and I hope readers get this, if you're going to have a baby with a friend and you don't want him to be the dad, don't have sex with him. Do it through a doctor. But if you do want him to be the dad, then it's much more relaxed.
How much, and again, you're talking about state and family courts, because as we know, and as we've seen, and as we've been talking about as a culture and as a society for the last several years, religious law often guides the decision. So And that's what is fascinating about the agreement that you put in the back of your book, that was your agreement, because it addresses all of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. And some of them are deals. So fortunately, my baby daddy is just the sweetest tempered person on the face of the earth. And so he really is very easy to deal with. And then when our son was 2.5, I meet this amazing woman who was willing to jump into the arrangement and become our son's second mom. And so because all three of us get along, and because she's Jewish and Victor and I are not, a new religious element has come in. And so we have lots of terms in that agreement that are about, you know, who pays for college, who pays for daycare, child's going to live with me, Victor's going to visit frequently. But then a lot of stuff just came up over time. So over time, whenever Victor's out of town because he lives in another city, he calls every night. And so when Karen and I, my wife Karen and I, were looking for a house, we looked for a house where there would be room for Victor's frequent visits. So that's not explicitly there, but the idea is written in between every single line that he's really a dad. This is what in the book I call a dad contract, which is different from a donor contract.
Maybe this is an unfair question to ask a law professor, but I'm gonna give it a shot anyway, which is in the day-to-day of your life, in the day-to-day life of your family, how much do you think about the contract?
That's a great question. You know, there are moments where there are crumbs on the counter, and somebody maybe is not as prompt. Usually it's me who's not as prompt as they might be, or it's just little irritants. I think, oh, yeah, I am really getting away with something to be able to manage to have this. It happened more early on as we were forming our relationship. We've all been in this game for years now. Our son is 11 years old, so I don't think about it that much. When big changes happen, that's what happens. So when our son is 5 years old, Karen and I get married. And then when he's 10 years old, his dad gets married to a wonderful guy who lives in Texas. So at those moments, we're very aware of it. But mostly it's just there in the background. It's like an insurance policy. You know you don't have to use it. You probably don't think of it much, but you might when you just miss having a car accident. And you probably think about it when you go to the dentist and you think, oh, I'm so glad I don't have to pay cash for all of this. But mostly it just takes your stress level down. Because if something bad happens, and this is why contracts are so great, because you think ahead of time, this is why people also hate lawyers, is that you think ahead of time on what can go wrong, you think of ways to prevent that bad thing from happening, and then if something bad still happens, you try to think of ways to make the damage less. So you're absolutely right. Your questions have really gone to this theme of why even look under the rug to see all those dust bunnies. And my response is those dust bunnies are making you sneeze whether you look at them or not. It's better to take a look at them, and then maybe you put that rug back. So I think we mask the contracts and deals that shape all kinds of relationships. And sometimes it's relationship enhancing, like when you go to dinner and you show up with a bottle of wine because you want to make some kind of contribution. It would be rude to show up with a $20 bill. It's all that masking is socially friendly. I think it's not so socially friendly to mask who, among the stories that I've heard are about single woman about to turn 40, asks her friend to give sperm, and they never talk about whether he's the dad. And a number of guys that I know end up getting just shut out. And I think that's bad for the kid and bad for the guy. And arguably, I think it's bad for the woman to have to be holding the bag all by herself. So it's actually more relationship enhancing to unmask what people are giving and getting in that situation. But you don't have to remind everybody every single day.
You said something early on that struck me, which was about just in our language of what you would say as a lawyer would be different than that of a psychologist. However, psychology is a huge part of this, isn't it?
Oh, huge. Well, of course, it's emotions and law are treated as if they're separate. But emotions, all you have to do is take a look at the fact that employment law disputes are as acrimonious as family law disputes, because a manager who's accused of sexual harassment or racism feels like a horrible person or somebody who's fired. So we are emotional people. The myth is that somehow we can walk around the world as like disembodied heads. Part of why I wrote in memoir is to link, and why I have the law chapters have a little snippet of garnish, I call it, of memoir along the way, is to remind people of what I call the heart of the deal, that there are emotions that are a part of any interaction. And with family, of course, these are the most relationships, the most important relationships in our lives. So I think it's better to, and part of why I hope to get into lawyers' conversations, I think it's better for them when people actually come to them for drafting of agreements to include this language that the lawyers told me is mush. The first time the woman who's my wife meets my son, she reads him Curious George and has political problems with the man in the yellow hat. And I put that in the contract. And the lawyer says, why do you want to put Curious George in the contract? Why do you want to put that in front of a judge? And I say, I want to put it in there so it never gets in front of a judge. That if things don't turn out, and I, you know, we get married in our 40s. I know that happy ever after is not a guarantee. If something goes wrong, then we have to look at that agreement, and I have to read the Curious George provision. And no matter how angry I am, that's got to pull something in my heart. And that hopefully would make me act like a human being and put the interests of my son first and remember that, even though I'm so insulted about whatever thing had made us, you know, start arguing in the first place.
I have great respect for you, for your work. I have great respect for you as an author and a lawyer. I have even more respect for you now than I know that you're the author of A Curious George Provision.
In fact, it's one thing that the lawyers are very curious about. I find some of the lawyers are like, duh, we put in these deals all the time. So in a divorce, they say, don't bad talk me to the kids. No court can enforce that, but that's standard. Other lawyers say no point in putting it in there if it's not binding. So you're right. It's a, and this is exactly what I was wishing, that that Curious George hook could bring to life this really amorphous question of how emotions can change over time.
This is all fascinating stuff. The name of the book is Love's Promises, How Formal and Informal Contracts Shape All Kinds of Families. The book is published by Beacon Press. Martha Erdman, I thank you so much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Love's Promises. It's published by Beacon Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.